Isaiah, Review and Chapter 40. The 26th talk in a series on Isaiah was presented by David Crabtree on March 16, 2014 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to be jumping back into the book of Isaiah. Chapter 40 is where we're going to jump in. But it's been several months, so I'm going to give a little bit of a review. And I'm going to try to make that review short. And then I want to talk a little bit about the issue of three authors of Isaiah, two or three authors. And then we'll jump into chapter 40. The book of Isaiah is hard to outline. It's hard to say that this is the flow of thought through Isaiah, because it doesn't really progress in that manner. It really progresses in what I think of as more of a spiral type manner. It'll offer some ideas, and then it will repeat those ideas, and then it'll move on a little bit further, and then come back and repeat some ideas that it's already talked about. So it's that kind of progression. But the ideas, the themes that it keeps advancing are easy to identify, and we will go through those. The context of Isaiah is that this book is primarily addressed to the people of Judah, the people of Jerusalem. That's not to say that the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel, is neglected altogether, but the focus is clearly on Judah and Jerusalem. Judah was the smaller of the two kingdoms, less numerous population, less wealth, and it is the one that now is the most fearful of some impending invasion coming from the east. What has happened, there are a number of things that have shaken up the world scene, and the most ominous of those, there are a number of changes that have been taking place, regime changes have been taking place in some of the key countries of the ancient Near East. But most significantly, Assyria has kind of regained its footing. It had been a major power earlier, and then it had declined, and now it's on the rise again. And the people of Judah know that if it becomes powerful again, it will start marching west, and it's going to conquer those countries that are in its way. And Assyria historically has been a very strong and ruthless militant society. So that's what they're worried about, is here Judah is, this little country, this little kingdom, in a world in which there are much bigger countries out there. And they are easy pickings for one of those countries to come along. And so what does Judah do? And the theme in Isaiah that Isaiah keeps coming to is, the people of Israel have lost their faith in God and his willingness and ability to protect them. And they have looked for other ways to save themselves, other ways to find security. Primarily through the government has been talking about allying itself with some of the other surrounding countries, Israel and Aram in particular. And God has warned them not to form those alliances, but the kings are still thinking about those, and in some instances, the kings do make alliances. And oftentimes with those alliances, the country that allies with a larger country is obligated to worship the gods of that other country. That's another way for the people of Judah to find security, is the worship of another god, and they are availing themselves of that opportunity. Isaiah argues that the reason that they are defecting from him, The reason that they are straying away is because they have lost track of their history and what God has provided for them. If we look at chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, he says, "Listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord speaks. Sons I have reared and brought up, but they have revolted against me. An ox knows its owner, and a donkey its master's manger, but Israel does not know, my people do not understand." Dumb animals know where their food comes from. Dumb animals know who cares for them. And yet the people of Judah have lost track of that. They've forgotten that. They haven't paid attention to that. As a result, then, God is going to come with discipline. And that's a theme that gets repeated a number of times, but it's right here in the next few verses of chapter 1. It says, starting with 4, "Alas, sinful nation, people weighed down with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, sons who act corruptly. They have abandoned the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away from him. Where will you be stricken again as you continue in your rebellion? The whole head is sick, and the whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot to the head, there is nothing sound in it, only bruises, welts, and raw wounds, not pressed out or bandaged, nor softened with oil." So the people of Israel have not recognized the care that God has provided. And we see hints of it later in Isaiah, that what they want is dramatic action, dramatic and overt action on the part of God. That seems to be what they're craving. God coming and responding very overtly to their various problems as they occur. That's not the kind of care that God has provided. The kind of care that God has provided is symbolized by the gentle waters of the Siloam. That's the spring in Jerusalem that churns out water. It's not a big stream. It would run through a culvert about 18 inches in diameter. It's not a huge stream, but it just keeps pumping that water out, and it has for years and years and years. That's an image of the kind of care that God has been provided. It has been constant, it has been reliable, but it has been just enough. It hasn't been dramatic. It hasn't been overt and big miracles all the time. And as a result, it's been easy to take that for granted. And that's what God is responding to. They have taken that for granted. And as a result, God has come in discipline. And as he's saying here at the very beginning of Isaiah, God has already taken action in that direction. He's already disciplined Judah. But there's more discipline coming. God has disciplined Judah such that there is no sound place on the body. It's been all thrashed. But there's more coming, because they are so resistant to see and recognize what God has done for them. And it's easy to see how they could take that kind of care for granted. It's, as we go through life, it seems like most things just happen. That we have food from day to day, but it just happens. Well, of course, that's what always happens. And there's always money to buy the food, and there's always the food to buy, and you can always put it on the table, etc. And it's easy to take that kind of care for granted, and that's exactly what they've done. So discipline is coming, and ultimately, and what's always in the backdrop of what Isaiah is saying, is the Assyrians are coming. In particular, it's the Assyrians that are coming, and all of the tumult and disruption in their lives that results from, that's caused by the coming of the Assyrians, and they're going to suffer all of that. So, to help them cope with this imminent attack, Isaiah keeps pounding on a number of themes, and those themes are, first of all, Israel as a nation is going to be humbled. There is discipline coming. Judah is going to be humbled. Israel will also, but we'll focus on Judah. However, Judah will not be destroyed, and that Judah has a glorious future waiting for it. It will be freed from oppression at the hands of its enemies. The authority of the various world rulers will be broken. Israel, in fact, will become the central point of the world, the place to whom peoples from all over the world come. And Israel will be at peace with God and with the rest of the world. And God's discipline will result in Judah, Israel, turning in repentance towards God, and Israel will eventually become, as a result of that, will become a truly righteous people. So that's the picture that Isaiah charts out for them, that this is what's coming. And his appeal is constantly, and therefore live in accordance with that future. So that's essentially what's happening through most of the chapters prior to this, chapters 1 through 39. At the very end, the last four chapters of this section, it switches into historical narrative and talks about the Assyrians actually coming. The Assyrians came. They came in might. They destroyed all of the major cities of Israel and of Judah and surrounded the city of Jerusalem. But then in the night, they disappeared. They took off and went back to Assyria inexplicably, miraculously. So God saved Judah from this the invasion of the Assyrians. So that kind of ends the first 39 chapters. That's essentially what Isaiah is talking about. A little digression with respect to this. It talks about the death of Sennacherib, who is the leader of the Assyrians when they invade Judah. And in the account in Isaiah, it says that Sennacherib was killed in a temple. An Assyrian tablet was found some time ago that has a historical record of Sennacherib's death, and it says that he was killed in his palace. And scholars have used that difference to argue that the author of Isaiah was trying to make a certain point, and to make his point, it was better to have Sennacherib die in a temple than to die in his palace. And so the author of Isaiah just changed that, changed the record of history in order to suit his purposes. Noah, in one of his classes, he was telling me, they have found another tablet, another Assyrian tablet, which was, and I'm not sure I'll get all of the facts of this right, but it was warning Sennacherib's heir that there are dangerous people around, and in order to prove his point, he goes through the assassination of Sennacherib in some detail. And according to this account, Sennacherib was killed in a chapel within his palace, which is very interesting. And Noah said that his professor, who is an expert on Neo-Assyria, that's the rebirth of Assyria, it's the Assyria that we're talking about here, said that there is a clear trend in scholarship of the ancient world, and that is they are finding that the ancient historians were meticulously accurate. And that's not, and he's talking about the Assyrian documents primarily, but he says the same is true of the biblical documents, that ancient historians are becoming more and more convinced that those documents written by the ancients were very accurate. And that's a real turn, because in the early 1900s in particular, up until not too long ago, really, the assumption was that they played fast and loose with the historical record, and that does not seem to be the case. Okay, as I've been working through Isaiah, my thinking has shifted significantly. When I first started looking at Isaiah, my assumption was that most of what Isaiah was talking about was the events close at hand, that Isaiah was talking primarily about the invasion of Assyria and had nothing else in view. But as I've been working through Isaiah, that's not tenable. There are too many cases where there are references that have to apply not to this coming invasion of Assyria, but to a much more distant event, an event of much greater impact. And so I began to see, well, there's some stuff about Assyria, and there's some stuff about the distant future. But as I've worked more and more on it, I'm reaching the conclusion it's not quite like that either. That Isaiah is looking at the invasion of Assyria, and then later the invasion of Babylon, as being dress rehearsals for a greater event that will come at the end of time. So everything that he's talking about with respect to Assyria and its coming is really has an analog. It has a greater fulfillment that's going to come yet at the end of history, at the end of time. And as a result, I'm now convinced that Isaiah is largely about the distant future to them rather than the close future to them. And the way that I'm thinking about it has been largely influenced by some study that I've been doing in Matthew lately, where Matthew quotes from Isaiah a number of times, probably more than any other Old Testament book. And when he quotes from Isaiah, sometimes he is quoting predictions of specific events that relate to the Messiah, relate to Jesus. But that's rare. What he does more often is what I think of, and this is a term that I came up with, I'm sure someone has a better term for it, but it's literary fulfillment. Matthew uses the term, and thus it was fulfilled. What Isaiah said was fulfilled. So he uses the term fulfilled. But my tendency when I hear fulfillment of prophecy is to think, well, there was a specific prediction, and that specific prediction happened. But as you look at the passages that Matthew is referring to, that's rarely the kind of thing that you see. Because if you go back to Isaiah, he's talking about something quite different. It doesn't seem to be a prediction of Jesus whatsoever. So what I've concluded in looking at Matthew and in looking at Isaiah is he is talking about a different kind of fulfillment, and I'm characterizing it as a literary fulfillment. And the reason I'm using the term literary fulfillment is because I am convinced that the whole flow of history, all that's happened with respect to mankind, is like a grand novel that is being written by the Creator God. And it has all kinds of intricacies in it. There are all kinds of themes that are woven into that story that God wants to present. They're intentional. They're there because he put them there. And they're woven into our actions and the actions of nations and everything that happens in human history. And as a result, history in a sense can be read like a novel. It has those features built into it. And what we're seeing with the Assyrian invasion is a kind of foreshadowing then of events that are yet to come. I've used these two examples before. I'll use them again because I like them so much. I hope they aren't taxing you too much. But they're both from J.K. Rowling. The first one is my son Noah is a huge Harry Potter fan and was a huge Harry Potter fan from the first book. In fact, he was one of the nuts that would go camp out in front of a bookstore the day before the book was supposed to be released. But he would read those and reread them, and he knew them in huge detail. But he was telling me that he read online a little incident that was written by J.K. Rowling and had just finished writing about the death of one of her characters. And she came out of the room just crying inconsolably. And her husband said, well, what's wrong? What's the problem? And she said, and I won't tell you the name of the character, but this character died. And he said, well, change it. And she said, I can't, because the story demands it. That there are certain things that an author sets up that are in play, and they have to kind of come together. They have to reach a resolution. The story demands it. The other example I'll use is this is Noah also. He read the first six books, like I said, several times. He knew them in great detail. After he had read the sixth book, he came to us and he said, I know what's going to happen in the seventh book. And he told us in rough outline what was going to happen in the seventh book. And that's what happened in the seventh book. Why is that what happened in the seventh book? Because the rest of the whole corpus demanded it. That's the only thing that would bring the different threads together. That's the only kind of culmination that would really fit. I think that that's what God has done. In the history of the world, in the history of mankind, God has created that kind of peace where he's woven all of these themes and threads into human history, and it's going to come to a culmination. And he's hinted at how it's going to end by foreshadowing, by talking about things that are similar but not quite it. And fulfillment is when those themes are brought to greater culmination. If that's what God is doing here, I think it's fascinating. Because the way I used to think about predictive prophecy, I always thought, well, why didn't God give more predictions with respect to Jesus? If he'd given more predictions, then it would have been really clear. Well, he didn't do that. In fact, if you look at the Old Testament, you look for specific predictions about Jesus, there are surprisingly few. At least that's my assessment. I found a website where it had all of the prophecies of Jesus, and I went through them, and I was surprised how few of them predict specific things about Jesus. I don't think that's what God has done. He's not going to overpower us with all of these predictions, overpower us with his knowledge of the future. He could have, but that doesn't seem to be what he's doing. Instead, what he's doing is he's saying, read the book. Study the book. Because if you read and study the book carefully, you'll see the themes that are being developed. And you'll see what it all points to. And when some of those themes then are developed further, you can say, of course, that's what should have happened. That's exactly what the story called for. And I think that that is Matthew's argument. That as you go through Matthew and he's talking about the fulfillment of Scripture, that's primarily what he's talking about. And in order to identify it, you have to understand the themes of the Old Testament. What God has done requires a much more understanding than if he had just given us a whole list of specific predictions that you could just check off. This requires a global understanding of what God's up to and what are the themes he's developing and how would those all come together and culminate. The issue of whether there are multiple authors of Isaiah, it was as early as about the time of the American Revolution that there were a couple of scholars that suggested that there must have been two authors of Isaiah. Because after chapter 39, there is such a change that the only good way to account for it is to say that it was written by someone else much later. And that concept slowly caught on and became the accepted perspective of scholarship. And then it was later posited that those last 26 chapters were actually written by two authors. The first, I can't remember where they say the split is, like 56. At 56, there's another split, and what was written, those last 10 chapters must have been written by a third author. And that has, until recently, that has dominated scholarship. But there seems to be a trend in scholarship that for about 100 years, Old Testament scholars were going through the Old Testament for the purpose of dividing it up and tracing it back, which piece was written by which author. The assumption was there were multiple authors everywhere. And so scholarship was really dominated by that kind of activity. Well, it's not so much that that was disproved, but that became tedious and dead end. Because you can always find a way to mince it more finely. And they were just dividing it up. No one was agreeing where the divisions are. But that's, everybody was looking for those divisions. It generated a lot of doctoral dissertations, but it didn't accomplish much beyond that. And there's been a trend in my conscious life. It started in the late 80s, early 90s. The scholarship started saying, you know, at some point, someone thought that Isaiah was a unit. Let's study it as a unit and see what we find. Because that seems like a more interesting activity than chopping it up, mincing it into phrases. And as a result, more and more scholarship has been going in that direction, looking at the books of the Old Testament as a unit, just for the heck of it. And as a result, they've been finding some things, finding some reasons to see some unity that had been ignored for the last 100 years or so. Isaiah is one of those books where there continued insistence on it being split up. There is an author by the name, there's a scholar by the name of Brevard Childs. He's a very well-known Old Testament scholar, and I can't remember whether he's at Harvard or Yale, one of those two. He, in his commentary, he writes the reasons why it was decided to split it at chapter 40. And he gives these three main reasons. First, the historical setting of chapters 40 and following appears to reflect an exile period after the fall of Jerusalem in 587 and the ensuing deportation of the Judean captives. So it looks like it's speaking to a different context, historical context. Second, there are striking differences in language, style, and concepts between the first and second parts of the book, which can be most easily explained by positing two different authors. So vocabulary changes, style changes, and the tone changes. Third, if chapters 40 and following were spoken by an 8th century prophet to the needs of an exiled people some 150 years in the future, it would be a situation without parallel in the rest of the Old Testament. So they're saying, we don't see that in any of the other books, where an author, for half of his book, would be addressing an audience that's 150 years later. Childs lists all of these and decides that, yes, there are some good reasons to think that this may have multiple authors. But then he proceeds in his commentary to treat it as though it's a unit, except where he thinks that's just not tenable. Another commentator, John Oswalt, who has decided to accept it as a unit, makes this comment. He says that the three main sections of the book differ significantly cannot be gainsaid. A novice Bible student with some skills and observation can feel the change in tone and focus at chapter 40. And it takes only slightly more perspicuity to detect a similar change at chapter 56. Further studies reveal a certain vocabulary is used in one section, but not in the others. Similarly, some theological concepts are restricted to one or another of the sections. Oswalt goes on to say, but so what? That yes, there is, you can see a change in tone and a change in focus at chapter 40. And another one is barely detectable in chapter 56. But Oswalt argues, but that doesn't mean there were more than one author. I'm inclined to go that direction. I'm not inclined to see them as being written by different authors. I'm inclined to see them written as by just one author. And I'm willing to assume that that one author is Isaiah. Why? Because I see no good reason to split it up. If I were to write, it is quite possible, and I think likely, that Isaiah wrote chapters 1 through 39 early in his prophetic career, and he wrote 40 and following much later in his prophetic career. And I think it is probably the case that if any of us were to write something at one point in our life and then write something else 40 years later, that there would be a change in tone and vocabulary. I think that's highly likely. And my suspicion is that that's what's happened here. Our oldest copies of Isaiah that date back to the time before Christ have the whole book of Isaiah essentially as we have it today. There is no evidence historically that anybody ever divided it up or that it ever existed in divided form. It's always been as a coherent, as one whole. So it would not be devastating to me if God were to come to me and say, Isaiah was written by three different authors. It wouldn't be devastating to me. But I just don't see the evidence to do that. I'm assuming that this is a coherent whole, all written by one author. And until I find evidence that's really compelling that pushes me in a different direction, that's the direction I'm going. Okay, let's look at chapter 40 now. As I've mentioned, as scholars have pointed out, there is a change in tone here, and you're all going to notice it. In chapters 1 through 39, the emphasis is on the coming discipline. And in order to help the people of Judah to survive that coming discipline, Isaiah spells out what is the future, though? Where is history going? And therefore, how would this fit into that? And tries to make sense of how this period of discipline could fit into that bigger picture. This part, when we start in chapter 40, there is a change in tone. Now the emphasis is on the encouragement. He is not going to abandon that theme of discipline. There are a number of instances where we'll see where that discipline is still talked about. But the emphasis now is clearly on encouragement, that God is in control of things. Don't worry. And his purposes will be accomplished. Furthermore, in this section, the context, as we will see as we work through here, the historical context does seem to be shifting. Before, in 1 through 39, it was talking about the impending invasion by the Assyrians. Now it's going to be the impending invasion by the Babylonians and the people of Judah taken into exile. And he seems to have as his primary audience those people in exile in Babylon. And I'll talk about that later. Do note and recall that in 39, the last chapter of that last section, it talks about Hezekiah showing his treasures to these strange visitors coming from far in the east. They were sent by the king of Babylon. Hezekiah showed him all of the treasures that they had collected in the temple. And Isaiah comes to him in verse 3 and says, what did these men say, and from where have they come to you? And Hezekiah said, they have come to me from a far country, from Babylon. And he said, what have they seen in your house? So Hezekiah answered, they have seen all that is in my house. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not shown them. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and all that your fathers have laid up in store to this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. So the last section leaves off with this ominous event that is yet to come. Okay, first two verses of chapter 40. Comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Speak kindly to Jerusalem and call out to her that her warfare has ended, that her iniquity has been removed, that she has received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. So it starts out, comfort, O comfort my people. So it's the imperative repeated twice. So this is being highly emphasized. There's a similar construction that he used earlier in Isaiah, where it's slightly different, but it's a similar construction, repeating the imperative. And in those cases, it was listen, listen, see, see, and then at what they were, at a list of their sins. But here it's comfort, comfort, and it's comfort my people. When he's really mad at his people, he calls them this people, not my people. So here, this is a much more affectionate kind of tone that he's striking. Go comfort my people, says your God. It's a much more personal connection that he's alluding to. And then it speak kindly to Jerusalem. And then this section is full of translation difficulties. There are a couple of words here that it is not clear what they mean. The Hebrew words, it's not clear what they mean. But what is said is, speak kindly to Jerusalem. That is, speak to the heart of Jerusalem. That is, encourage Jerusalem. Call out to her that her warfare is ended, that her, and this, it says iniquity in my translation, but it is more likely that what is meant here is hard service or hard labor, that her hard labor has been removed. And then this one, that she has received of the Lord's hand, the word double is a difficult word here. It's hard to know exactly what that means. Has received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Here, for double, it seems to me that it's more likely that this word means in abundance, that she has received of the Lord's hand in abundance for all her sins. So what's happening here, what God is declaring to the people of Jerusalem is the warfare is ended, so their troubles, their conflict, and it's literally a military conflict has ended, that her hard service is over. And there, I think, is primarily the spiritual. It's the turmoil, the pain, the suffering has ended. And she has received of the Lord's hand an abundance for all her sins. And it's hard to know what the abundance, and it can be in all of her sins. It's hard to know how the abundance is fitting in here, whether it's talking about the sins, whether it's talking about what was received. But I suspect that what's being said is there is abundant blessing that is now coming from God at the conclusion of the abundance of discipline for the sins. So this is a declaration. Things are changing. There is an end to this. The next three verses. A voice is calling, clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness. Make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Let every valley be lifted up and every mountain and hill be made low. And let the rough ground become a plain and the rugged terrain a broad valley. Then the glory of the Lord will be revealed and all flesh will see it together. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. So a voice is calling. We don't know who the voice is. It doesn't say. There's no real good clue. It's just this disembodied voice is calling out. What the voice is saying is that it is commanding that a way be cleared, that a road be prepared. And we have seen a number of instances where a highway or a roadway has been referred to in Isaiah. He's used it on four occasions in particular. But in all of those occasions, it has been in reference to the people of Israel coming back to the land or the righteous coming to the land. Now, this is a highway being prepared for God himself. There was apparently a practice in Assyria that when the king was going forth with his procession to another country, that a large crew would go before him and clear the way and make it so that his chariot could pass through easily. And that would appear to be the background to this statement. What's being called for is that the roadway be prepared so that God can come through, this roadway that goes through the wilderness. I suspect here that the wilderness is symbolic. I'm not sure exactly what it's symbolic of. Oswalt thinks that what it's saying is that God, in a sense, he came down at Sinai, and that now he's coming forth from Sinai through the desert. I'm not inclined to think that that's what it is. I'm inclined to think that the wilderness here is some reference to the unexpected, the uninhabited, from nowhere. He's coming from nowhere. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure what it means. It could be from some place where there's no life, but he's coming. And it is necessary to prepare the way for him so that he can come in his procession, make his way to his land and his people. And when he comes, the glory of the Lord will be revealed and all flesh will see it together. Everybody's going to see it. It's like God's been there, God's been working, but it hasn't been overt activity, and it's easy to say there is no God, and that all those promises that God had made earlier, those are all a fantasy. But, in fact, he is coming. And when that happens, everyone will see him, and his glory will be apparent, will be obvious. This section is referred to by Matthew with respect to John the Baptist. And that's, I just take a minute to look at that because I think it's kind of interesting. The text that I have here reflects the Hebrew version of Isaiah. When it was translated into Greek, the Septuagint, which was, that translation was done in the 3rd century BC, it was translated a little bit differently. And it was translated to read, "The voice of one calling in the wilderness says, clear the way, da 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 da." So it makes the wilderness not the place where the roadway is prepared, but the place where the voice is speaking, which fits very well with John the Baptist. But if you look at, we have parallelism here. Parallelism is everywhere in the Old Testament. Parallelism is where it will make two statements, which are oftentimes, I won't get into all the intricacies of this, but oftentimes they are essentially synonymous. It says the same thing two different ways. And here we have, clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness, make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Those are essentially synonymous statements. So I am confident that this, the Hebrew text, it corresponds to the original, what Isaiah wrote. And that the Septuagint, it messed it up a little bit. Whether it was messed up before they translated it or what, I don't know. But it's a little bit messed up. Matthew then looks at the Septuagint version. He uses the Septuagint version to say, you know that voice calling in the wilderness? That fits John the Baptist. Now, I don't think that he's playing fast and loose with the Old Testament. I think he has picked the Septuagint translation because it is more appropriate for John the Baptist. But his point is, go back and look at Isaiah. And what you see in Isaiah is when God comes, there is someone calling out that the way needs prepared for the coming king. And that's exactly the role that John the Baptist served. So I think he used the Septuagint just because it points to John more clearly, and it makes a better association with John. But Matthew isn't relying on that. Matthew is saying, so go back and look at Isaiah and see what Isaiah said. I think that's what's going on. Okay, then there's another voice that speaks in verse 6. A voice says, call out. Then he answered, what shall I call out? All flesh is grass, and all its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades, when the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. Get yourself on a high mountain, O Zion, bearer of good news. Lift up your voice mightily, O Jerusalem, bearer of good news. Lift it up, do not fear. Say to the cities of Judah, here is your God. Behold, the Lord God will come with might, with his arm ruling for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his recompense before him. Like a shepherd, he will tend his flock. In his arm, he will gather the lambs and carry them in his bosom. He will gently lead the nursing ewes. So a voice says, call out. The wording here is reminiscent of way back in Isaiah chapter 6, I think it is, when Isaiah was first called. Let me read just a little bit of it. Chapter 6, verse 8. It says, then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Then I said, here am I, send me. And he said, go and tell this people, keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull and their eyes dim, lest they see with their eyes hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and return and be healed. Then I said, Lord, how long? And he said, until the cities are devastated and without inhabitant. And I won't go on. But there's a kind of interaction. It's a dialogue between Isaiah and God, spelling out the assignment that God is giving to Isaiah. I think that here in chapter 40, this is like a second commissioning. We've got a little bit of that same interaction, and this then would be like a second commissioning. The first commission was to tell them that disaster is coming, and this one is going to be the good news of how history is going to end up, that God is going to come and fulfill his promises to Israel. What he says here is all flesh is grass, and all its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The imagery that he's using here is human beings, humanity, are like this fragile plant. And we're talking, the context here is in the desert. So we've got a fragile plant in an arid area. And all it takes is one hot wind to blow, and that plant withers and dies. Humanity is like that fragile plant in a desert setting. And this is important in the context in which he's speaking, because Judah was taken captive by the Babylonians, and they were taken into exile, and they are being held there against their will. And why can't they leave? Because Babylon has too much military force. They would just crush them. And it appears to them, it has to appear to them, that Babylon has unlimited power. It's just huge. It is so big that there is no way that that power will ever be broken, and that they will ever be able to go back, and that God's promises can ever be fulfilled. But God's message here through Isaiah is all of mankind is but a fragile plant. All I have to do is breathe on it, and it dies. It's gone. But in contrast to that, the word of our God stands forever. God's promises, they will happen. No human being can get in the way of that. No empire can get in the way of that. God's promises and his purposes will be fulfilled. You can count on that. Then get yourself up on a high mountain, O Zion. So this is addressed to O Zion and O Jerusalem, bearer of good news. That's euangelizo from that verb. It's the word for gospel, good news. So Zion, Jerusalem, are going to be the bearers of good news, and the good news that they are going to bear, and they're going to bear that good news to the cities of Judah. They're going to proclaim it to their countrymen, and they're going to lift up their... Okay, then it goes on to say, here, the good news is, here's your God. He's here. He's come. And he's come, and there are two different metaphors, two different symbols that are being used to capture the nature of God here. The first one is he has come like a mighty warrior. And the second one is he has come like a shepherd. The mighty warrior, it says, behold, the Lord God will come with might, with his arm ruling for him. So it's talking about God in action, God using the strength of his arm to accomplish his purposes. Then it says, behold, his reward is with him and his recompense before him. Again, the translation here is a little difficult, but I think the idea is he is coming with his bounty. He is coming as a victorious warrior with his loot, and that will be made available to his people. So that's one image. The other image is a shepherd, and he will tend, like a shepherd, he will tend his flock. So here we've got gentleness, nurturing, caring. In his arm he will gather the lambs and carry them in his bosom. He will gently lead the nursing ewes. So when God comes, it will be in fashion that can be captured with these two images, as a conquering warrior and as a caring shepherd taking care of his flock. That's the news that needs to be proclaimed by Zion and Jerusalem to Judah. He goes on, 12 through 17. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and marked off the heavens by the span, and calculated the dust of the earth by the measure, and weighed the mountains in a balance, and the hills in a pair of scales? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has informed him? With whom did he consult, and who gave him understanding? And who taught him in the path of justice, and taught him knowledge, and informed him of the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket, and are regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. Behold, he lifts up the islands like fine dust. Even Lebanon is not enough to burn, nor its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. So here it's talking about the grandeur of God, his greatness. He measures the waters, the mountains. And I think in measuring all of these things, I think it's kind of hearkening back to his creative activity. He's following the blueprint in creating the universe, and he's capable of doing that. There is no peer for God. There's no one who has his understanding and his wisdom and understands justice and knowledge the way that he does. He's incomparable in that respect. And the nations, once again, the nations are like a drop from a bucket. So all the people out there, they are insignificant compared to God and his strength and his power. They're like specks of dust on the scales. Verse 16, God is so great that even Lebanon does not have enough trees to provide a burnt offering. It doesn't have the trees or enough animals to provide a burnt offering for God that would be fitting for God. And then it summarizes that all the nations are as nothing before him. They are regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. The word here is, this is a word that appears in Genesis chapter 1, where before God created the earth was formless and void. The word that's translated void is the same word here, bohu. And I think, again, he's kind of hearkening back to the creation in that the nations, what are they compared to God? They aren't the creator. They aren't the orderer of things. The nations are the disordered matter that God used as his putty to create the universe. They're just putty in God's hands. The next section. To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare with him? As for the idol, a craftsman casts it. A goldsmith plates it with gold, and a silversmith fashions chains of silver. He who is too impoverished for such an offering selects a tree that does not rot. He seeks out for himself a skillful craftsman to prepare an idol that will not totter. So now he's saying, who is God likened to? Well, the obvious thing would be an image that's been made to look like God, an idol. But there is no idol to God. The other nations have idols. They've captured God in an image. But in so doing, well, how did they accomplish that? They have one person who casts it. They have another person who plates it with gold. They have a silversmith who fashions the chains of silver. And then verse 20 is difficult of translation. And I think that Oswalt does a better job of translating that, if I can find where he translated that. His translation is, he selects valuable sisu. I've never heard of that before, but he says that's a wood that grew in Assyria. He selects valuable sisu, a wood that will not rot. He seeks for himself a wise craftsman to fasten an idol that cannot move. What we have here is the image of an idol being made. And in order for this idol to be made in a way that's appropriate for the god, we have a number of craftsmen who are all contributing to this project. But when it's all said and done, they aren't sure whether it will stand. It's not given that this thing is stable. God surely cannot be likened to that. The next section. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the vault of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers who stretch out the heavens like a curtain and spread them out like a tent to dwell in. He it is who reduces rulers to nothing, who makes the judges of the earth meaningless. Scarcely have they been planted, scarcely have they been sown, scarcely has their stock taken root in the earth, but he merely blows on them, and they wither, and the storm carries them away like stubble. To whom then will you liken me, that I should be his equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high, and see who has created these stars, the one who leads forth their host by number. He calls them all by name, because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one of them is missing. So he's saying, look at this creation. Is it not obvious that it was created, and it was created by a God who loves order and justice? It's built right into creation, evidence of who I am. And God sits above, up in the heavens, above the vault of the earth, and we are as grasshoppers below him. And the heavens are stretched out like a tent for him, a vast, enormous tent where he lives and where he has his domain. Rulers, human beings, by contrast, are nothing. He is able to reduce rulers to nothing and judges to, and here's that word again, tohu, to chaos, to nothingness, insignificance. And then he alludes back to that image of grass that's in the desert and God just blows on it and it disappears. He says here, scarcely have they been planted, been sown, and taken root, then God blows on them and they wither and a storm carries them away. So, given this, to whom is God to be likened? Is there anyone as equal and obvious? This is a rhetorical question. There is no one that is comparable to God. God is the one who leads forth the host of the stars in the heavens. He knows them all by name, and he calls them out. Not one of them is missing. The last section. Why do you say, O Jacob, and assert, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and the justice due me escapes the notice of my God? Do you not know? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. He gives strength to the weary, and to him who lacks might, he increases power. Though youths grow weary and tired, and vigorous young men stumble badly, yet those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not become weary. So here it starts out with basically accusations from the people of Israel. And what they're accusing is God has lost track of us. God doesn't care to bring about what should be done with respect to us. The justice, the rightness, the goodness that should come our way, according, and I think that's according to the promises that were given. But the response is, don't you know, haven't you heard, this Creator God, he doesn't get weary or tired, and his understanding is inscrutable. He hasn't worn out, he's still carrying out his purposes. His understanding is inscrutable, and I think that is, it's beyond our comprehension. And I think built into that, what he's trying to accomplish is also beyond our comprehension. He's the one who gives strength to the weary, and to him who lacks might, he increases power. Young men, they get tired, and they stumble badly. But God sustains those who look to him for strength, and he continues to be a source of strength for his people. Okay. I find it interesting that this section is it's not really a proof that God exists. It's not trying to make the case to someone who has given up on God. It's making the case to the one who has grown weary. It's making the case to the one who is having difficulty sustaining their faith. You can imagine their situation. They've been taken away into exile in Babylon. There are all these promises that were made by the prophets in the past about Israel, and that Israel would occupy the land, and that it would become, the people of Israel would become like the sand of the sea, and they would be a place where people from all over the world would come who are seeking righteousness, etc., etc. All of the promises that God had made about a king who would reign forever on the throne of David, etc., etc. They've heard all those things, but now Babylon has come. They have destroyed Judah. Not only have they destroyed Judah, they've destroyed Jerusalem, and they've destroyed the temple, and they've taken the people out of Judah, and they've moved them to Babylon, and they won't let them go back. So they're living in Babylon, and they're surrounded with a very different cultural context. They're surrounded by people who don't believe the promises of the prophets. They're surrounded by a culture that thinks that Marduk is supreme, and they've got evidence to prove it. They've got the strongest military in the world that has been able to defeat one country after another. So the people of Israel, it's easy to see how it would be difficult to maintain the faith under those circumstances. And that's the context into which Isaiah is speaking. And what he's saying is, if you look at creation, it's clear that there is a good and loving God who established this whole thing. And he is continuing to carry out his purposes. And he is continuing to fulfill the promises that he has made all along the line. And that God is the God of Israel. That God is Yahweh. And one day he's coming. And when he comes, he's going to be shown in all his glory. And you know those Babylonians that seem so intimidating and inconquerable, it will be made very clear when that happens that they are like the grass that's going to wither and blow away when God breathes on it. They are no competition for God. It's no contest. Therefore, then, be encouraged. Rekindle your faith. Hold on to those promises. This is all part of what God was doing. It's all part of the plan. And the time is coming when he's going to show himself for who he is. It seems to me that that's the context into which he's speaking is one that's not entirely different from our own. And Bob's comments at the beginning that even in our community, you can see why people have strayed away from the faith. Because in many respects, God is not actively and overtly acting in our lives in ways that you look at it and say that it is obvious that that is the activity of God. He's acting more like the streams, the gently flowing waters of the Siloam. But it's easy to take that for granted. And it's easy to see how it would be possible to wonder whether all these things that are talked about in the Bible, and that there is a God, and that he spoke through the prophets, and he made these promises, and he's actually going to fulfill them, and all that sort of thing. When you're surrounded with a culture that doesn't believe that, it's easy to think, no, that's all a fantasy. It's all old-fashioned fantasy. But Isaiah's point is, there is much about reality that shouts at us that there is the God that claims to be. And that will be shown to be true in time. But hang in there as the time comes. I identify very strongly with the fellow in Mark, in the book of Mark, where he comes to Jesus and he says, Lord, I believe, help me in my unbelief. That we're all in that kind of fragile situation where, yes, there's belief, there is recognition of who God is and what he's doing. But sometimes it just doesn't look that way. Sometimes you have to wonder, is he really doing his thing? Is he really, does his account of reality make sense of things? And I think ultimately it does. I'm confident that ultimately it does. But it's hard to hold on to that. So I think it needs to be all of our prayers that, Lord, I believe, help me in my unbelief. Okay, I went over time. I think it'd be best if I just quit. Thanks.